At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
See, that wasn't so hard now, was it? Didn't take much more than the threat of the end of the world to get a bailout deal done. The House and Senate are mostly on board. The White House says it's happy. I guess it's all over, but the voting. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, committed to helping Americans save on gas and become energy independent at publictransportation.org. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the studios of WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 25th of September. Great to have you with us. Our continuing coverage of the mess in the financial markets comes to you from Cleveland today. And I have to tell you, I got an earful this morning from a lot of really angry people. I'll explain that in just a bit. But first, an update on the politics of this unbelievable economic story. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is at his usual post today, keeping track of a story that seems to change by the hour. Hi, John.
Hello, Kai.
All right, so big package here. What's in it?
Well, congressional leaders earlier today announced that they did have an agreement, although they were kind of short on the details, and they took that agreement later in the day to the White House in a meeting that included President Bush and the two presidential candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama. Now, that meeting has broken up without any announcement of an agreement, even though earlier today, Senator Christopher Dodd of Connecticut and Representative Barney Frank of Massachusetts both said that they had reached a basic agreement on just about everything.
Now, in anticipation of your questions, we're not going to go into the details of this. Clearly, we now need to meet with the Treasury Department and go over these principles which we've agreed on among ourselves, and obviously go back to our respective caucuses to talk with them as well.
As the concerns of the Democratic members of the House were brought to me and to the Speaker, I can report back to them, as I will, that we have been able to accommodate the bulk of them in very responsible ways.
Now, some Republicans say they're not convinced this really is an agreement and that it'll hold. But one who was inside the negotiations, Utah Senator Robert Bennett, he seems convinced.
The most encouraging thing that comes out of it from my point of view is that I now expect we will indeed have a plan that can pass the House, pass the Senate, be signed by the President, and bring a sense of certainty to this crisis that is still roiling in the markets.
You got to love Chris Dodd saying, in anticipation of your questions, we're not going to take any questions. Kind of leads you to believe that there's more going on here than really meets the eye. What don't we know?
Well, there was one issue that they could not agree on at all, and that's this Democratic idea of allowing judges in bankruptcy proceedings to change the terms and the interest rates of mortgages. So that's still up for grabs. Also, we don't know who's covered under the restrictions on executive salaries. Is it just the CEO, or is it the top five or the top 20 executives? We don't know the price that the banks will have to pay to participate in this. They'll have to give the government some sort of equity in their companies, but we don't know how much or what form, and that could be a big sticking point. Also, congressional leaders said that they will provide the $700 billion in installments, not all at once, but we don't know how much the initial payment will be, although there are reports that it will be $250 billion.
Have to ask you about the 800-pound gorilla here, John, or I guess all three of them, the two presidential candidates and the incumbent in that office. They're obviously meeting at the White House this afternoon.
Yeah, all in one room. This has caused some grousing from the negotiators up on the Hill who've been deep in the details for days now. And there's some who worry that the presence of these two presidential candidates, you know, their attempts to jockey for the best position could jeopardize progress. Still, there now appears to be lots of momentum behind this package, even though there are still some details to be worked out. It looks like that they're going to have some votes in the House and the Senate as early as tomorrow or Saturday.
If there is a deal, then, do you think John McCain's going to go down to Mississippi for the debate tomorrow night?
That's unclear. He hasn't said whether he's going to participate. Obama says he'll be there.
John Dimsdale, our Washington bureau chief. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kai.
Back a couple of months ago, Henry Paulson used a line in congressional testimony that I'd bet he'd rather not have said right about now. Talking about a possible bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Paulson said he had to have a bazooka in his pocket. That is huge financial authority, but he said he'd probably never have to use it. We all know how that turned out now, didn't we? But as John mentioned, in the deal lawmakers announced today, they are going in the other direction, not giving the whole $700 billion in one shot. What Wall Street's eventually going to think of that, we don't really know yet. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's pitch has been pretty straightforward. Give me the money and make it snappy. Here he is on ABC.
We need this to be clean and quick, and we need to get it in place.
But some lawmakers are saying, wait a second, let's dole the money out. They want to establish benchmarks for the bailout. Once a benchmark is met, Wall Street companies get a little more cash. Bruce Jostin is the Chamber of Commerce's chief lobbyist. He says dribbles of cash won't do much to ease the credit crunch.
Credit depends on confidence, and what we have in front of us right now is a lack of both.
Jostin says if you drag out the bailout, investors will lose faith in the plan, a fatal blow to the economy.
I don't think that's a fatal blow to anything.
Bill Cheney is chief economist at John Hancock Financial.
I don't think it makes any difference that it comes out in, let's say, $150 billion installments. These are still some pretty big numbers.
And Cheney says it's impossible to spend $700 billion all at once. Hugh Johnson of Johnson Illington Advisors understands both sides, but...
Now, that's the political process. Neither one's going to come out on top, and just as in any political process, there has to be compromise.
Johnson says both sides need to listen to the ultimate authority, taxpayers, who want to slow down and figure out where their money is going. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
News that the $700 billion might not come all at once didn't do any overall market damage today, but just like when you and I run short between paychecks, folks who need a steady cash flow to do their Wall Street business aren't all that happy. Over the past couple of weeks, the interest rate that banks charge each other for short-term loans has shot up dramatically. Banks are afraid to lend, as we've said, because they're afraid they're not going to be paid back. Now, money market rates are soaring as well. From New York, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
You don't hear much about money markets until they freeze up.
If these markets don't unfreeze, it is probably the single biggest threat to the economy from this crisis, this financial crisis.
Milton Ezrati is a senior economist and strategist for Lord Abbett and Company.
Most of the economic activity in the United States is carried on through these short-term instruments. Most of the working capital for corporations is financed through these short-term instruments. So if this market freezes up or becomes difficult or is too costly, it can really put a crimp in the economy.
Just as banks borrow money from each other at low interest rates, big U.S. companies rely on the money market for cheap short-term loans. They use the money for everything from buying inventory to paying employees. Right now, the loans have gotten too expensive because lenders are scared they won't be paid back. Investors and corporations are pulling cash out of money market funds which back these loans, and that's brought the short-term lending market to a grinding halt, says Guy Labat. He's chief fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott.
Institutions aren't willing to make loans, and that's what's really troubling, that the sort of entities that need cash in the markets and even ones that need it for a day-to-day operations are having a lot of trouble getting it and are paying up a great deal.
Labat says what's needed to unfreeze the markets is confidence. He says the $700 billion government bailout will probably do the trick. The problem, he says, is that it may be 3 months before the money reaches the markets, and U.S. companies may not be able to wait that long. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The wider markets gave a vote of confidence to the bailout plan today, what we know of it anyway. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As you know, if you caught it up at the top of the broadcast, I'm in Cleveland today at WCPN. As you might also know, Cleveland's in the unfortunate position of having a whole lot of foreclosed properties in and around its city limits. Northeast Ohio has been feeling the pressure of a sliding economy for a good couple of years now. So when people hear the government wants to spend $700 billion to rescue, as they see it, a bunch of big banks that made some bad decisions, they're angry. And when you get them on the phone, that anger comes through loud and clear. I sat in this morning on the local talk show here, The Sound of Ideas, it's called, hosted by Dan Malthrop.
Gary's with us now from Lakewood. Hey, Gary.
Thanks for taking my call. You mentioned that there was a problem with the way they rolled this out, and I couldn't agree more. They rolled it out as the $700 billion bailout. There were never any other alternatives put on the table first, or even saying, we really need to talk about this as a nation. We've been put in panic mode again, and we've been burnt in panic mode twice. We got burnt after 9/11 with the Patriot Act being passed that basically shredded the Constitution, and we got burnt in the lead-up to the Iraq War with WMDs. I think they have a crisis of trust. We're in panic mode, and we don't believe them.
Trust, of course, is the problem here. The banks don't trust each other, and because they haven't really been told what's going on, people don't trust the government.
Joining us now from Eastlake, Alicia, good morning.
Yeah, I just hope that all these things are, whenever they come to a final determination, are explained to the American public.
Because
that's what I'm saying, right.
Exactly, Alicia.
I find this very frustrating. And then I think that some of these financial instruments that are being put out there are so complicated that the average consumer doesn't even understand it, and the Wall Street giants don't even understand it, the impact of it. I think that somewhere down the line, things have got to be simplified so that everybody knows where we're at and we're all on the same page.
Alicia, thank you very much.
Now to Elaine from here in Cleveland.
I have a pretty simple question for both of you, and this has to do with the definition of the so-called crisis. What I want to know is why this crisis is being called the crisis for the American people, the crisis for us all. Why are you, who are the political economic commentators, talking about this in such a universal way and not talking about it in terms of the very specific group of people who have made billions of dollars on this greedy and rapacious appetite having to do with the economy?
I'm going to tell you what I told Elaine this morning, that there is a universality, that what happens at the highest levels of finance among those big Wall Street banks we keep telling you about, that does affect your car loan and my credit and your neighbor's mortgage. Because if they're not lending to each other because they don't know how much bad debt is on a borrower's books, then your auto finance company and my credit card company and the bank that holds your neighbor's mortgage won't have enough cash to keep on lending. What the government's trying to do, and there are a lot of other ideas out there, and a bailout may or it may not be the best plan, but what it's trying to do is unload that bad debt to get the trust and eventually the money flowing again. Coming up, when the personal cost of health care gets too high.
We had already decided, basically, in the waiting room that we would sell our house, we would move into an apartment, downgrade our cars, and obviously I had to go back to work.
But first, let's do the numbers. Now that Congress is dealing, Wall Street investors are more willing to wager. After 3 days in the red, the Dow finally closed up 196 points, 1.8% at 11,022. The NASDAQ gained 30 points, 1.4% to finish at 2186. The S&P 500 added 23 points. That's almost 2%, wrapped up the day at 1209. As you might expect, financial stocks were the big winners now that Congress is zeroing in on a rescue deal. Morgan Stanley rose 9%. J.P. Morgan Chase climbed 7%. Bank of America gained almost 4%. Citigroup is up more than 2% today, but there still wasn't much investor woo-hoo behind WAMU. Still don't understand that advertising slogan, by the way. Stock in Washington Mutual fell another 25%, despite reports of a last-ditch scramble to save the troubled savings and loan. The stampede into the safe corral of government bonds eased up just a little bit today. As prices declined, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.84%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy. global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management. Online at shrm.org. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up for Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the final second quarter gross domestic product report. A House committee holds a hearing on Lehman Brothers. The focus is Chapter 11 bankruptcy working. And more information on how folks feel about the economy. The University of Michigan survey on consumer sentiment is released. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Melamine has now been found in food outside China. That's the industrial chemical that was added to Chinese milk and baby formula. It's been linked to four deaths, and it's made tens of thousands of Chinese babies sick. Inspectors in New Zealand have found it in imported Chinese candy. Vietnam has temporarily banned imports of Chinese milk products. And tomorrow, the European Union is going to start testing all Chinese imports that are more than 50% milk powder. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman looked into whether this is another Chinese product safety scare that's about to go global.
So is there any danger of melamine from Chinese milk turning up in cocoa mix or cookies on U.S. grocery shelves? Well, never say never, but experts say the chances are pretty low, at least in food products made in the U.S. or actually any place other than China. Almost no milk or milk byproducts are exported from China to the U.S. James Morehouse of management consulting firm A.T. Kearney has studied food safety in China.
If you've got a food product as an ingredient, and it's going to, for instance, Nestle, they're going to test it very thoroughly before they use it. So I would reassure people not to worry about milk.
But China does export a lot of other food to the U.S., apples and chicken and juice. Morehouse says it's more likely one of those products will eventually turn up in a U.S. grocery store tainted with pesticide or mercury or growth hormone. Caroline Smith DeWall is director of food safety for the Center for Science in the Public Interest. The group visited a Chinese grocery in suburban Washington looking for Chinese imports made with milk.
We found bottled milk drinks, bottled yogurt drinks in sizes clearly intended for children. We found a variety of cookies and candies.
DeWall stresses that the group hasn't tested any of these for melamine. The FDA says it has found no melamine contamination in the U.S. thus far and has warned against buying Chinese-made baby formula at Asian grocery stores. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As Mitchell suggested, outside Chinese grocery stores, chances are pretty slim that you're going to run into milk or protein products here that are tainted with melamine, especially if you're the type that eats out a lot. A company you've probably never heard of operates the biggest collection of sit-down restaurants in the United States. Or, if you have heard of it, you probably know it by its brand names, International House of Pancakes and Applebee's.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Dine Equity CEO Julia Stewart. 6 years ago, times weren't so good at IHOP. Stewart was hired to shake things up, and she did pump some life into those time-worn blue A-frames. Now, though, she has a new challenge. Last year, Stewart engineered the purchase of Applebee's, about as troubled as IHOP was back in the day. So when we sat down, I asked her how you turn a company around in a down economy.
I can't control the economy or who's going to win the election. I think we should spend all of our time and attention at Applebee's on improving the brand, improving the food, the things we can really control.
You've been in IHOP since 2001. Everything's going fine. You turn around a year ago and say, I think we need to go buy something.
Why did you feel that way, and why Applebee's?
So we had actually announced in 2006 that we would look at strategic alternatives, including an acquisition, because we realized we had a limited sort of space in IHOP. And in early 2006, when we said that, it was like looking for a needle in a haystack, because it had to be big enough to matter, and it had to be something that wasn't competing with our existing franchisees, so it couldn't be in the family dining category. It had to be something else. And in early 2007, Applebee's announced its intentions to possibly sell, and we began to look at it. Clearly, it had sort of the halo had worn, and it was not fresh and new, and it literally needed exactly the kind of thing that we had done with IHOP.
So the deal closes, everything's fine, signed, sealed, and delivered. You sit down with the board of directors, and they say, okay, hotshot, now what are you going to do? How do you take a company like Applebee's, which was in some trouble, and make it into what you want it to be?
Well, the good news is we'd had those conversations long before we ever made the acquisition. The board was not only supportive and aware, but very much in line with the fact it's not going to be something you fix in 30 days. It was going to take some time. And because they had gone through it at IHOP, they were very cognizant and supportive of what was going to be involved.
I was in an Applebee's not too long ago, and there's not really much difference between, say, Bennigan's and TGI Fridays and Chili's. I mean, they all sort of blur together, and it's not possible I'm the only consumer out there that feels that way.
No, you're absolutely right. That's one of the things that we were quite aware of when we first undertook the acquisition. And consumer research said this. I mean, it's not like you just
right.
made it up.
Yeah,
we know for a fact that we had this vanilla same image as a lot of other folks.
How do you fix that?
Literally, we've gone out and asked guests at Applebee's, what would make you come more often? And they say the same thing. Fix the food. So I'm like, okay, those are fighting words. We're going to fix the recipes, the specifications, the back of the house. We're going to come up with it. We're going to fix this food. I spent 2 hours with the onion ring guy in Hawaii. I'm not kidding, saying, I want the best. And he's like, well, Julia, I mean, I want the best onion ring. That's what Applebee stands for.
Julia Stewart is the CEO of Dine Equity. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
You can learn more about Dine Equity and hear conversations from other corner offices on our website. It's marketplace.org. Every time I have to open one of those envelopes from my health insurance company, a little chill goes down my spine. Because I know that inside there's one of those explanation of benefits letters, which more often than not launches me on a voyage deeper inside this country's healthcare system. Navigating that system and increasingly fighting it can be expensive. With coverage shrinking, people are looking for help to deal with the details. There are doctor's appointments to book, insurance companies to pay, medications to monitor. But there are companies that will shoulder that burden for you, for a price, of course. Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll reports now on the growing ranks of healthcare handlers.
Oh my goodness, sleepy eyes.
Nicola Fusana King picks up her 2-year-old son, Caden, from a nap. He has a little cold. King's not worried. She's already seen the worst. When Caden was 2 weeks old, he woke up one night having trouble breathing. King couldn't reach the doctor on call, so she went straight to the emergency room.
So we started rolling him down the hall, and he arrested full in the hall. So I looked down and said, oh my God, I don't think he's breathing. He's gray. And so
doctors revived Caden, who was diagnosed with a severe staph infection. He needed weeks of quarantine and expensive medications. King wasn't concerned about the cost because she and her husband had insurance. Then she found out her son wasn't covered under the policy. Within the first 4 days, the Kings racked up $300,000 in medical bills.
We had already decided, basically in the waiting room, that we would sell our house, we would move into an apartment, downgrade our cars, and obviously I had to go back to work.
The Kings paid about $100,000 of the bills and fought with their insurance company over the rest. Desperate for help, Nicola King hired Guardian Nurses. It's a company that provides advocates who help people negotiate the healthcare system. So for $1,500, King outsourced her fight with the insurance company to health advocate Betty Long.
I just made copies of thousands of pages of stuff that I had at that point and sent her box after box. And then she would just send me literally weekly updates.
Betty Long had been a nurse for 25 years before starting Guardian Nurses.
It became abundantly clear to me that patients were not finding it easy to navigate the healthcare system. And I thought there has to be a way in order to, you know, to kind of help those folks get through it.
Health advocacy companies make up a tiny fraction of the healthcare field. But experts say the market is growing as people feel squeezed between full-time work and full-time management of their family's healthcare. Advocates can search for specialists, book doctor's appointments, and keep track of medications. They'll also manage electronic health records and provide a second set of ears during a consultation. Laura Wild directs the only health advocate training program in the country at Sarah Lawrence College in New York.
You know, in the old days, we had a more paternalistic model of medicine, that you had a family doctor who made choices for you, you trusted that person, and that person saw you through from the beginning to end of your treatment. That's certainly no longer true.
This fragmented system doesn't just affect family members, but employers too. Dealing with healthcare at work eats into productivity. Michelle McGaffey oversees human resources for a small nonprofit. She's thinking about adding the health advocate service as an employee benefit.
The ultimate goal, I think, for a benefit like this would be the overall savings for us, both the bottom line savings, but also just from the lack of resources that we have here in the human resources area.
Companies pay around $60 to cover an employee for the year. An individual who hires a health advocate could pay $300 for a day of help at the hospital, or a lot more for round-the-clock care.
You want to see the race car?
Yes.
The Kings, if you remember, negotiated a $1,500 fee with Guardian Nurses to take on their insurance battle. And it paid off. After months of wrangling, Betty Long had the Kings' entire bill, about $200,000, written off by the hospital and the insurance company.
You know, without her, I just don't know what we would have done without her, honestly. I just don't know.
Now King's pregnant again and thinking about having Betty Long on call, just in case. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
We've got more information on health advocates and some links you can follow to do your own research on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, an Ohio-based real-life punctuation mark to that money market story Jeremy Hobson brought us. Goodyear is based down the road from here in Akron. The company said today it hasn't been able to get its hands on $360 million it has in a money market fund. The Reserve Primary Fund stopped allowing withdrawals last week after a run on the bank. That means Goodyear is going to have to borrow the money and, of course, pay interest on it. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 196 points, 1.8%. The NASDAQ added 30 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 bumped up 23 points. That's almost 2% there. Kevin Arnovitz, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Thanks today to the staff here at WCPN in Cleveland. We're going to keep our coverage of the fallout from the financial crisis on the road. We'll have reporters traveling the country over the next couple of weeks. We'll be doing the broadcast from St. Louis 2 weeks from tomorrow. And speaking of tomorrow, coming up, a chance to ask, what the heck happened this week? I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back in Los Angeles tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.